"Look here," I said, "have you ever pulled a shrub out of the earth?"
"Yes," he said.
"What did you see in the ground then?"
"Little wooden pipes by which the plant feeds itself."
"Well," I said, "the fire-eating frames get their food through metal pipes."
"Out of the ground?"
Decidedly, I had to give up giving technical details. I tried to explain things by means of a sketch rapidly drawn on a piece of paper, but in spite of his remarkable intelligence, Shikaru could not make head or tail of it. It was probably the first time in his life that he had ever seen a drawing. "How difficult it is to understand, Pilinpa," he said with a sigh. "Never mind all these details. I gather from what you say that the frames eat fire. Anyhow, they must have excellent digestions, and no doubt a good deal of smoke comes out from them from behind. Not precisely from behind, but there is some dudpa footnote. Anyhow, tell me," he went on, "do these fire-eating frames move fast?"
"Often 15 times faster than the fastest yaks can go. Tibetan yaks usually move along placidly at the footnote. Smoke. Rate of less than 2 miles an hour, so there was no exaggeration in saying that modern means of transport move 15 times faster."
"How extraordinary," observed Shikaru. "Fire-eating frames moving 15 times faster than yaks. Tell me, why do white people want to travel 15 times faster than we do?
Why?"
"White people want to travel faster," I said after some hesitation, "because they want to be happy. The faster they travel and the higher houses they build, the more they think they will be happy."
"And are white people happier than we are?"
the clever boy went on asking with rather embarrassing consistency.
"No," I said, feeling rather ashamed. "They are not happier than the Tibetans."
"This is very strange," Shikaru went on. "White people use fire-eating frames to be happy. They build Kanpatanthanpo footnote, as you say, in order to be happy, and yet you say they are not happier than we, who have no fire-devouring frames and no high houses.
Why?"
There was a long pause.
"Why?"
he asked again.
"Tell me why."
"Listen, Shikaru," I answered. "White people seem to be afflicted with a strange nad.backslash. They invent more and more. They make life more and more comfortable. But while they are doing all this, they complicate their lives more and more and create additional needs. So in the end they are not better off than in the beginning." A hailstorm had come on rather suddenly. "They footnote. Very high houses. F disease. Are very frequent in Tibet in the summer. Enormous hailstones were coming down and I could feel their impact through my thick Tibetan clothes. When we found that some of the hailstones were the size of a walnut, we lay flat on the ground and covered ourselves up with our belongings, waiting patiently until the hailstorm was over. It lasted only 10 minutes, leaving the ground covered with a layer of ice several inches thick. Then the sun came out. The air became as clear as crystal, once more illustrating the fact that Tibet is a country of the greatest contrasts climatically. We had shivered with cold 2 minutes before and now the heat was almost tropical. Huge masses of ice disappeared rapidly in the hot sunshine and small torrents appeared everywhere. We knew that the ground would be fairly dry very soon and remained seated for some time. Our talk about Western countries had greatly excited Shikaru's interest and imagination, and as soon as the hailstorm had passed he reverted to the same topic. "You said that white people are in the habit of complicating life and creating additional needs," he observed. "I am very curious to know what they are doing to complicate life." I thought of the difficulty I had experienced a short while ago when trying to give him a description of a motor car. To convey to him an idea of Western complications was no small job. Furthermore, the Tibetan language is not at all suitable for giving any descriptions of a technical nature. When used for describing material things, Tibetan is very primitive and leaves but little margin for expressing details. Only in describing spiritual and immaterial things, Tibetan permits of expressing an enormously wide range of shades of meaning. I heard at least 6 different terms in Tibetan to translate the English word hermit. Footnote. For such ideas as meditation or spirituality, there is a voluminous vocabulary.
In spiritual matters, many Tibetan words require a whole sentence to convey their meaning in English. But it is just the opposite where material things are concerned. Then, in many instances, one English word may require several dozen Tibetan words to convey even an approximate idea of its meaning. It was no use trying to describe complicated Western machinery and conveniences to the young Tibetan. So I started with complications of the simpler variety and mentioned smoking in the first place. Even then it was difficult enough. As smoking is unknown in most parts of Tibet, there is no Tibetan word for it. I said, then, white people often adopt the habit of putting small chimneys into their mouths and blowing dagpa out of their noses. Xiukari laughed heartily and then asked, footnote, Xanspa, Gumtspin, Dagshrun, Bsangdanpa, Nalyapa, and Rufai. Perhaps the reader will try to learn these six terms by heart to get an idea of how difficult it is to learn Tibetan. Plus, for instance, the Tibetan word Dondon Mdenpa means the sort of self-consciousness which gives one an erroneous conception of the real value of things. But how can they keep the chimney in their mouths? It is a small chimney, Xiukaru answered. It is not difficult to keep it in the mouth at all. Nevertheless, I am sure, small as it is, it does fall out continually, he said. Why? I asked, astonished. Well, if someone puts a small chimney into his kafutnot and blows smoke out of his nose, he must be so shaken with laughter that the chimney drops from his mouth. No, Xiukaru, I observed. White people never laugh when putting chimneys into their mouths. Xiukaru absolutely refused to believe me. Whatever I put forward to convince him of the contrary, he repeated again and again, Sunbayin, Sunbayin. Look here, boy, I said, after a good deal of unsuccessful persuasion, once people get used to strange things, they cease to laugh about them. You have many strange things here in Tibet about which you never laugh. You have had them for centuries, but you failed to see their comical side because they have lasted so long that you have got used to them. Nearly all people live and think habitually. We then talked about Tibet for many hours. The boy was very clever and an excellent observer. The few dozen remarks he made about his countrymen showed deep understanding and threw very footnote. Mouth. F it can't be true. Much light on Tibetan conditions and the mentality of the Tibetans. Xiukaru placed great confidence in me and treated me like a friend whom he might have known 10 years. Suddenly he asked, tell me, are white boys very different from me? No. One answered, not very. Boys are very much the same all over the world. Most of them are full of enthusiasm and sincerity. And grown-up people? In many cases, both their enthusiasm and sincerity diminish as the years roll by, I said sadly. Are grown-up people very different in various countries? Yes, very. Why? I tried to convey to him that lack of enthusiasm and sincerity finds expression in many different ways, which differ widely, whereas sincerity and simplicity leave no room for diversity, and that was why boys were so alike all over the world. But my knowledge of Tibetan was too limited to make the boy understand exactly what I meant. I should like to meet white boys, said Xiukaru suddenly. If you are very useful to me during my travels here in Tibet, I said, I may take you back with me to Pienpa. His enthusiasm knew no bounds. Is the language of the Pelins footnote very difficult? No, I replied, it is very easy. One thought of footnote. White people. How dreadfully difficult it had been for me to learn Tibetan. By the way, I said, there are many Pelin languages, but at least one of them, English, is known all over P/ITIPA. What does one mean in the most useful language of the P/INS? One, I replied. Van, he repeated, Van means power in Tibetan. Van, Van, Van. This is very simple. I shall not forget it. In less than an hour the clever boy had learned 24 English words. The word go he learned by remembering the Tibetan word ngo or go, head. The word come by scom or come, thirst, etc. So painstaking was he in his effort, and put me to so much work, that we both felt tired after an hour or so. While we talked, we had, of course, been walking all the time in the thin mountain air at a speed of about 4 miles an hour. He reverted to the problem of white boys. This topic seemed to be of special appeal to him. Tell me, he asked, if a white boy came to Tibet, what would he laugh at? Well, perhaps at your fear of ghosts. We halted to take some food. Everybody here seems to be afraid of ghosts, he observed, after we had started munching uncooked barley meal, which he swallowed very bravely. Even the bandits, otherwise very courageous fellows, are afraid of them. They people even the dunghills with evil spirits. My little brother was murdered by them. Gap-a-sent-yug. Footnote. I asked. Evil spirits knocked during the night at the door of the house of my parents. The poor little boy called Nanduk Yod / while he was still only half awake. Thus the demons got hold of him. He caught fever and died some time afterwards. As he thought of his little brother, his eyes revealed great soul passion and an immense capacity for suffering. He seemed to be quite different from many other Tibetans who seemed to me to be incapable of such deep feelings. Are you never annoyed by evil spirits? He asked after a slight pause. No, I answered. Why? Probably because I am not afraid of them. Suddenly the young Tibetan seized my arm and pointed northward, whence we had just come. At a distance of a little over a mile, a group of people was moving towards us. Jeogpa El, he cried. We finished our meal and marched on southward. The bandits were not mounted, and still a long way behind us. So I hoped we might be able to make our escape by marching on as fast as possible. However, the faster we went, the faster we were followed by the bandits. It was a most unusual experience to be hunted by brigands in uninhabited territories. What on earth could induce a gang of robbers to move across this barren part of Tibet where not even nomads lived? The bandits patiently followed our footprints. Footnote. How? T coming. Percent robbers J keeping up a brisk pace, and at nightfall, in spite of all our efforts, our lead had hardly increased to 1.5 miles. If the brigands intended to follow us during the night, they would have to light torches to see our footprints. As long as no light was visible at a distance, we were safe until daybreak, but, tired as we were, the boy and I had to keep a strenuous lookout alternately all night. It certainly was a painful necessity to sacrifice half a night's rest after walking 30 to 35 miles the previous day. Soon before sunrise, we were on our way again. A quarter of an hour later, we again saw the robbers at a distance. There was no vegetation in the district. Footprints were very easy to follow, and the undulating character of the landscape permitted to see people approaching at a considerable distance. We marched as fast as we could. But the faster we walked, the more the bandits increased their speed. By about noon, our advance had increased to something like 2 miles, and from time to time the gang entirely disappeared from vision. The time had come for trying to mislead the robbers. When we reached a small saltwater lake in a depression, we both entered the lake and walked on for some time parallel to the shore. Then we took a good jump, touching the ground well beyond the waterline, and marched off at top speed at right angles to our previous direction. When we reached a mass of debris, we went into hiding behind it to take some rest. About half an hour later, the brigands arrived at the lake. They saw at once that we had entered it and began to walk round it to find the place where we had left the lake. From the place where we were in hiding, we could see them very clearly, as the air was as clear as crystal. To his terror, Xiukaru recognized the robbers. They were his own gang, from whom he had fled. One, he recognized his brother, who came in rank next to the leader. Obviously the robbers had decided to fetch back their colleague, and that was why we were hunted in entirely uninhabited territories. One, the situation was far from pleasant. Other brigands who would have no special reason to overtake us apart from their desire to rob us might have given up the pursuit once they had lost our track. But in this case it was to be expected that the bandits would not leave a stone unturned to get hold of us. Xiukaru absolutely refused to go back to them voluntarily. Moreover, now that he knew that I was a white person, he realized that further contacts with the gang might lead to very serious trouble as far as I was concerned. The bandits closely followed the waterline and walked past the place where we had jumped out of the lake. It would take them nearly an hour to walk round the lake before they realized that they had been baffled and began to walk round the salt lake in a wider circle. Xiukaru, who seemed to be thoroughly fed up with his brigand's job, exulted. He was determined to get away from the gang as much as I was myself. A quarter of an hour later the bandits were far enough to make it possible for us to leave the place where we were in hiding. We crawled up to the next ridge, which was a few hundred yards distant, and the earthen color of my tent thrown over us stood us in very good stead. As soon as we were beyond the ridge we marched off eastward as fast as we could, putting in a few hundred yards run from time to time. We stopped for short periods only to eat, and when night had fallen we kept up a watch alternately. During the second half of the night the boy wakened me. A faint glow of fire was visible in the distance. The bandits had probably realized that we were much too resourceful and energetic fellows to be caught at all unless they took up pursuit by day and by night. Having walked round the lake a first time they had realized that we had been tricky enough to make them walk 4 miles in vain, thus gaining a tremendous advantage. They had begun to walk round the lake a second time in a much wider circle until they had found our new track, and when our footsteps showed them that we had walked and run alternately they understood that they would never get hold of such tough customers unless they decided to sacrifice a night's rest to continue the pursuit. We marched on in the darkness, the stars showing the direction. Xiukaru, tired as he was, seemed to view the whole affair in a sporting manner and stood the test very bravely. In addition to strong feelings and bright intelligence, he seemed to have a powerful will. He began to talk. I brought home to him that we were in for a desperate fight and could not afford to lose the slightest amount of physical strength, all our lung capacity being necessary for getting along as fast as we could. As soon as we reached a place suitable for wiping out our footprints and misleading our pursuers, we suddenly changed our direction and moved off southward. Half an hour later the sun rose. The boy's feet began to blister a little. Brave as he was, the depressing effect of exhaustion made itself felt. Living mostly on uncooked barley meal, walking and running 45 miles in a day and having only half a night's rest can affect even a strong and healthy man. Gakarat Yugchuch. Footnote. He asked again and again. After a while he added sadly, Yo, you must not be taken prisoner by the llamas. My brother is a Mayabi percent and Bo/backslash, but if we are caught and he finds out that you are a white person, the worst may happen and he may hand you over to the priests. After a short rest we marched on non-stop for about 10 hours. The boy's feet blistered more and more, but he absolutely refused to stop. When I offered to take him on my back he bit his lips and said firmly, me, me, me. Percent then I approached him and got hold of him to put him on my back by sheer force, as I had seen a few drops of blood coloring his footprints, but he footnote. What can we do? T.A. good man. Percent no, no, no. Resisted vigorously, and I finally had to give up trying to get hold of him. Our situation had become quite desperate. On reaching the top of a particularly high ridge we could see the brigands, who had made up a considerable part of the distance separating us, and again followed us at a distance of about 2.5 miles. Must explain in this connection that in the desolate expanses of northern and central Tibet, which are devoid of vegetation and where the air is as clear as crystal, people approaching at a distance are visible many miles away, if they do not happen to be hidden by a ridge. It was obvious that we should be caught the subsequent night if the robbers decided to march on by the light of a torch, which was very probable. Moreover, even if we could avoid them by an almost miraculous turn of good luck, our food supply was running out rapidly and the cutting down of food rations would have to be started in a day or two. Then nature herself came to our assistance. Just when we marched through a depression late in the afternoon there suddenly came a rumble as if 100 railway trains passed underground in the immediate vicinity. Big boulders and debris rolled down from all sides. It was the first of a series of earthquakes I had to face in Tibet during the next few days. It lasted several minutes and was so violent that it was difficult to keep one's feet. Xiukaru calmly dodged the stones and seemed to be quite used to this sort of thing, but more and more blood appeared in his footprints. It was probable that the earthquake had affected a very extensive area, wiping out our footprints radically. Most probably the gang would have lost our track. Since we were both tired to death, we put up the tent as quickly as possible and soon fell asleep. When I awoke, it must have been about noon the subsequent day. It was raining very fast. I looked round. Xiukaru had disappeared. I looked out. No one was within sight. I shouted in all directions. No answer. What had happened to the boy? I walked out into the rain to examine the surroundings. Torrential rain had wiped out all footprints. I had not the slightest clue pointing to his whereabouts. As a portion of his belongings was still in the tent, it was impossible to guess whether he had the intention to return when he left it or not. I waited for hours, going out from time to time, shouting his name at the top of my voice. Nothing could be heard except the continual fall of heavy rain. Evening came, and the boy had not yet returned. Maybe the poor chap had gone out for a short while during the night, intending to return immediately, and had lost his way and gone out into the desert. This occasionally happens to Tibetans. The Tibetan multitudes believe that under the influence of invisible demons, the sense of bearing of men leaving their tents in a desert may be temporarily lost, so that they walk in the wrong direction and cannot find their way back to their tents, to the great joy of the demons watching their victim going to his death in the desert. If the poor boy had made the dreadful mistake of losing his way, he was likely to go to certain death. He had neither the geographical knowledge nor the experience of a man who had crossed alone the various deserts of the world, and would walk about in circles and die miserably of hunger and exposure. All night I kept a sharp lookout. During the second half of the night the rain stopped, and soon afterwards I kindled a small fire to show him the way in case he had gone astray. Morning came and Xiukaru had not yet returned. I knew it was my duty to wait, although every minute of my time was precious. Northern Tibet would be snowbound in a couple of months, making it impossible for me to return if I hesitated too long, and by far the larger part of the work for which I had undertaken the expedition and faced all the attending hardships and privations was still ahead of me. I also realized that it was impossible for me to stay in disguise in the forbidden country during the whole winter without being found out. Just now, when after enormous efforts and hardships I finally was within a few hundred miles from the goal of my journey, the mysterious monasteries and hermits I was in duty bound to stop for some time in order to wait for this poor boy lost in the desolate expanses of Tibet. All I could do for him was to wait for some days, keeping watch day and night and lighting a small fire during three successive nights to show him the way. I had not the slightest clue as to where to seek him, and I fully realized that by roaming about in those uninhabited territories I had no greater chance to find him than a man looking for a little pin in a haystack. Moreover, my food supply was now running out very rapidly. All I could do was to signal my presence during the night. I even sacrificed a small portion of my equipment in order to keep burning the little fire which I kindled every hour during several nights. In the daytime I could do nothing except wait. Had I left the immediate neighborhood of the tent, I should have run the risk that the boy might have found me absent on his return. He could not read, so I could not leave a message. After 3 days I started southward, in a semi-starved condition, with infinite sadness in my heart. Up to this day the fate of Xiukaru remains a mystery. Did he actually lose his way, meeting a slow and terrible death from starvation and exposure? Or did he leave me voluntarily because he felt that his presence was an additional danger to me? Or did the brigands find our track after all and take the boy back without wishing to work harm to me, since I had rescued the life of one of the members of their gang a few days earlier? Taking all in all, however, the first alternative unfortunately remains by far the most probable one. What thoughts may have crossed the mind of this clever and kind-hearted boy while he wandered about there in the barren solitude, slowly dying from hunger and exposure? Is it credible that the splendid unit of bright intelligence, intense feeling, and strong willpower cloaked into a sheath of matter which I met in the physical form of Xiukaru was a mere chance creation of heredity and environment. Is it probable that when this bud, just about to open into a flower, was cut off by fate and dropped dying on the ground of the desert, the supreme goal of this soul should have been annihilation? Perhaps many years hence some solitary wanderer will come across a heap of bleached bones in the desolate wastes of western Tibet. Is that all that is left of Xiukaru? Chapter 2 Demons descending. A very large number of Tibetan monasteries and perhaps the most mysterious ones have never been visited by white people. They vary considerably in size, location, and the attitude of the monks to the visitor, who, in most cases, however, is treated like a welcome milch cow possessed of only a moderate amount of discrimination and resourcefulness and therefore open to be mulcted very thoroughly, regardless of the fact whether he happens to be Chagpa footnote, or poor. Some of the monasteries, like Tashi Jemb, are very small and accommodate not more than perhaps 300 monks, others are at least 10 times larger. Some of the monasteries, such as the Disogchen Monastery, are located far to the north of the country in almost entirely uninhabited territories, but many of them are in the fertile valleys in southern Tibet. The number of pilgrims varies greatly according to the time of the year. The festivals, of course, provide the greatest attraction, and on those occasions a gay and cheerful atmosphere reigns supreme. Footnote. The Tibetan word Chagpo, rich, is derived from the word Zbug, which means cattle. So rich in Tibetan really means becatted. This reminds one of Latin, capita capital, and pcus pecunia. It illustrates the importance of cattle breeding as a means of living in Tibet. 4 footnote. In strange contrast to the teaching of the Buddhists, asserting that all life is inherently bad and that escaping from the wheel of rebirths and all forms of material existence is the supreme goal of the Buddhist. Not far from the place where I had studied various meditation exercises practiced by the lamas, I heard that one of the famous oracles of the Tibetans, a so-called Sungmai, was about to visit the nearest monastery and that several thousand pilgrims were flocking to the place in order to witness the demons descending to earth temporarily to take possession of the body of the oracle. When I arrived at the monastery, it was quite easy to see that something exceptional was going to happen. Large crowds of pilgrims poured into the gates from all directions. Small tradesmen had established themselves to sell food and other necessities, and there reigned an atmosphere reminding one somewhat of a good-sized fair at some western country town. Busy-looking lamas in bright clothes moved about, and an unusually large number of temple flags and other decorations were hung out everywhere. The demons were expected to descend into the body of the Sungmai in the presence of a very large crowd. Moreover, the lamas had decided to provide an additional attraction by performing a religious play the following day. Theatrical performances in Tibet last much longer than in Western countries and are rehearsed most painstakingly. From time to time, the crowds moving to and fro in the narrow passages gave a good stare when one of the lamas went to the rehearsal wearing the strange robes and masks in which they were to appear in the show. Just after turning a corner, I met three lamas wearing striped robes and gigantic masks hiding their faces. Each of them also had a sword in his right hand. My miniature camera, with which I could take photographs of about 2/3 of an inch by 1 inch, was hidden in the left sleeve of my Tibetan clothes, footnote, and I could not resist the temptation to raise the arm a little to take a snapshot when the lamas were a few yards distant. It was a risky business, but worth the trouble, as although so small a photograph taken under such conditions seldom permits of sufficient enlargement, it is nevertheless a document of considerable scientific value. As none of the lamas nor any of the many Tibetans filling the passage had noticed anything, I became a little bolder. A few minutes later I reached a kind of small square where a lama performing in the show had halted and was stared at curiously by a small crowd of Tibetans. He was wearing a mask representing a skull, and ribs were painted on his chest. Obviously he was intended to impersonate a walking skeleton in the show. He did not seem to be inconvenienced by the curious stares of the crowd and even posed a little so that they might examine him thoroughly. The crowd kept a respectful distance, and as the sun shone very brightly too, I could not resist the temptation to once more raise my left arm in order to take another snapshot. However, this time I had a very narrow escape. The Lama and a few other Tibetans heard a footnote,